Welcome to the Cynica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, back in town this week, and joined, as usual, by the ineffable Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind Danwei.com. How are you, Jeremy?
Very good. Very good evening to you, Kaiser.
We are delighted to welcome back to Cynica Jeffrey Wasserstrom, professor of history at UC Irvine, prodigious columnist and editor, most recently of Chinese Characters, a collection of essays by many well-known China watchers from academia and journalism, featuring portraits of people in contemporary China. Great to have you back, Jeff.
Great to be here.
And we're very honored to have with us the novelist, essayist, and cultural commentator, one of a rare breed of true public intellectuals these days, Pankaj Mishra, author most recently of the book From the Ruins of Empire, The Intellectuals Who Remade Asia, or in its original UK title, The Revolt Against the West and the Remaking of Asia. Welcome to Cynica, Pankaj.
Thanks very much.
Let me start with a question about that title, or rather the subtitle itself. Which is the more accurate, the American version, The Intellectuals Who Remade Asia, or the UK version, The Revolt Against the West and the Remaking of Asia?
Very much the UK one. The UK publishers did not entertain for a minute the American version, quite rightly, because they said a book with the word intellectuals in the title would be dead on arrival in the UK.
That's funny. Really, I mean, I think that it would be dead on arrival in the U.S. as well.
Perhaps not among the book-buying public.
Maybe. I mean, there's still a few left who self-identify as intellectuals. But why in particular? Is it not just the word intellectual, but this business of revolt against the West? Was that something that the American publishers found objectionable?
I think it is probably a bit too provocative for an American audience. I'm just speculating. Because I don't think the word intellectuals really quite fits the characters I describe in my book. I mean, they were thinkers, but thinkers very much on the run, on the move constantly. They were not sitting in libraries and working up huge systems of thought.
Pankaj, could I interrupt you at that point? And maybe we could start with there are three main characters in the book, right? Most of them, I mean, were probably unfamiliar to a lot of our listeners. I wonder if we could start with a sort of potted biography or a sketch of the three main characters in the book.
Well, the first figure I describe, Jabaluddin Al-Afghani, born in Iran in the 1830s. Now, he was in many ways the first sort of Muslim to outline the great danger Western imperialism posed to Muslim societies, whether in India or Iran or Turkey or Egypt, because he had a kind of experience of it in India soon after the suppression of the British mutiny there, of the Indian mutiny there in 1857. And he absorbed those lessons and he took them wherever he went, Egypt, Iran, Turkey, and told people that if they were not careful, if they did not strengthen themselves quickly enough, they would be overwhelmed by European imperialists. So he traveled across a very broad swath of territory and associated with some of the leading thinkers, anti-colonial nationalists, wherever he went in Iran and Egypt, and developed sort of acquired disciples amongst these thinkers. So it became hugely influential in all of these countries. Died fairly young, but not without leaving a very deep imprint on the thought of the next generation of Muslim thinkers and leaders. The other figure, the second one, the story I take up in the 1890s is Liang Qichao, who your audience would be much, much more familiar with.
You presume much of our audience.
We hope.
But, I think of him very much, Jeff here might correct me on that, but I think of him very much as sort of foremost modern intellectual, the first one to start thinking about a mass public, start publishing periodicals for them, introduce histories, educate really the sort of first generation of the Chinese intelligentsia. So again, a huge influence, although his political impact was limited. It was the second generation of Chinese thinkers who sort of absorbed his lessons and his ideas and took them in a very different direction. But again, great traveler, wrote about America extremely perceptively on his trip there, a great diagnostician of Europe's problems. So very important
thing. Tocqueville character.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he of course was very instrumental in the Hundred Days Reforms of 1898, after which he sort of fled for his life and spent 14 years in Japan. In a past life, I worked on Liang quite a bit. Really, really fascinating character. There's another major figure in your book, although you might not rank him among the real protagonists. Al Afghani and Liang Qichao are clearly who you spend your time on, but Rabindranath Tagore, the Bengali poet, Nobel Prize-winning poet.
And a great friend of Liang, who invited Tagore to visit China in 1924, and that was a hugely controversial visit.
That's right. We'll talk about that in some length. That's really because this is a China-focused podcast, I, not surprisingly, want to drill down on these two figures, specifically on Liang Qichao and on Tagore, and especially in the case of the latter, how his ideas about an Eastern spiritual civilization were received or weren't received in a China that was very much in the throes of cultural iconoclasm at the time and a wholesale repudiation of the Confucian tradition. I wanted to talk a little bit about the book, of course, and get into a deeper discussion about nationalism, about liberalism, about neo-traditionalism, about all the different forces that were in play in the China of the early 20th century. And I think this is a perfect book for that. What made you decide that it was time to introduce or to reacquaint an English reading audience with figures like Al Afghani and Liang Qichao?
Well, two things. First, that the sense that the post-colonial histories we'd all grown up with, whether you were in China or in India or in Turkey, had somehow failed to account for what was happening in the contemporary world. And then, of course, the other sense that the histories authored, written, published in the West, in London or Paris or New York, simply excluded, even very major figures like Gandhi from their accounts of the world in the last 150 years, and obviously would have had no place for these figures like Al Afghani or Liang. So the sense that there was a whole cosmopolitan moment in Asia, which has been obscured by, you know, both these post-colonial nationalist histories and also these larger imperial histories. So I wanted to sort of recreate that moment when a whole lot of very important critiques of nationalism, of Western liberalism, were mounted. And those critiques have much to say to us at this point when we are faced with a sort of very deep crisis of modernity in general.
Yeah, I believe that this was very much of the moment, and you can't help but read it and reflect on the current situation, not only, of course, here in China, but also in the Middle East. I think even though things have played out very differently in the two, I think initial conditions were sort of similar, and we'll explore that a little bit. Jeremy, though, you and I were talking earlier, and you mentioned that you wanted to push our guest a bit on his very confident use of the word Asia, the notion of Asia, which I think you thought was
right. You must have had this question a number of times before, but I mean, does it make any sense to group everybody from Egypt or possibly even Morocco all the way to pretty much Pearl Harbor, everybody in between? Is that a classification? Is that a way? I mean, is Asia a concept that's useful, and why is it useful in your book?
I think it can be useful conceptually if you think about people from Turkey all the way to Java being united by this shared experience starting the mid-19th century of being humiliated by a superior power and feeling themselves inferior, weak, and then starting a massive project of, you know, national consolidation, self-strengthening. So that unites people of very different cultures, very different traditions, very different histories. So that's something that I was, you know, that context that I was invoking this notion of Asia. Of course, there were other definitions around at that time in the late 19th century, and people tried to resurrect, and Tagore was one of them, and many Japanese and many Chinese, in thinking of a spiritual notion of Asia, an Asian sort of held together with a very different view of human possibilities, of the good life, and a particular kind of emphasis on certain things, quite opposed to this sort of vision of life that had emerged in Europe at that time. But, you know, these are slightly airy-fairy notions. But I think for me, what was conceptually useful about the idea of Asia was that, you know, the political experience of so many people in that part of the world, and the shared challenges, similar challenges, and, of course, the astonishing similarity of responses to that challenge of Western power.
If I can cut in, one thing that unites it is the book begins with Japan beating Russia in 1905 in a war that was a kind of cataclysmic, changing moment. And so one of the ways that your working definition of Asia comes out is anybody who
responded
with excitement to Japan winning and thought, that tells us something we could be. And you show that going at least as far as Egypt.
Absolutely. And I also point out the problems in that whole sort of movement towards pan-Asianism when Japan appropriates that and turns it into an imperialist project. So obviously, you can't stretch that too far, this notion of Asia awakening under Japanese leadership, because we know that how that script turned out.
Well, I want to thank you for not indulging in a preemptive sort of defense against imagined critics from the post-whatever school that would have attacked you on it.
If I can just push just a little bit further, like, why then would one exclude, say, South Africa? I mean, the ANC in South Africa was founded in, I think, 1912. So, you know, and there were other movements in Africa that perhaps were a little later than Asia, but not that much later. Is, you know, why exclude them?
Well, I mean, I think a very simple reason. The book has to be a manageable one, that it has to be 350 pages long, and there are certain experiences, even within Asia, it had to exclude. For instance, I haven't really talked a great deal about what happened in Java.
Right.
So there are parts of Asia that are not discussed. I haven't talked about what happened in Ceylon, Sri Lanka. In Africa, the movements, the nationalist movements there did start a little later. I mean, definitely much later. There was very little trace of it in the late 19th century. Even in the early 20th century, if you look at the whole map, there are very few sort of anti-colonial movements there in sight at that point.
Okay. Satisfied?
Yes, satisfied. Let's
move on. I want to dive in and start talking about Liang Qichao and put a question to Jeff. Somebody like Liang Qichao, who's an intellectual whose ideas really undergo rather pendular swings over the course of his active years, how does something like that fit into the contemporary narrative of China, either as told by the official custodians of that narrative or by academe in the West? How does he fit?
It can go two ways if you go through these evolutions. Either there's some part of your career that can always be seized on to be celebrated even when the regimes switch around, or you can be just too hard to understand, so you drop out. Sun Yat-sen would be a good example of a figure who changed dramatically over time, but in enough ways that different people could appropriate him
and
fit him into the narrative.
Everyone, right.
And so he's the one person who, both on Taiwan and the mainland, can have this kind of sacred balance.
So too with Liang, right?
Liang to some extent. Right. But Liang, I mean, what's interesting about Liang in a lot of ways is he influences so heavily people who go in different directions.
That's right.
So that then you can trace back in that way. That way. And so he influenced Mao tremendously, was often noted, but he also influenced Lu Xun enormously. So you can sort of say without him in the picture, all of these figures who loom so large would be very different. And he was also just so varied, not just ideologically varied, but his interests.
He was
a big promoter of science fiction. He was the first person to say Chinese should read a lot of science fiction because he didn't ever say this, but it's a twofer. You learn about the West and you learn about science. You learn literature.
You're only saying this because you just read a China Miéville novel.
Yeah, I'll get to that. I'm setting myself up for my recommended reading.
Right. But let's. I mean, it might be a useful exercise for us to actually go through the different stages in Liang's development, what the formative events or influences that you folks would identify as marking off those different stages. I mean, he went from an unreconstructed self-strengthener to a full-blown cultural iconoclast, who was really repudiating Confucianism, embracing destructionism, the full package of Enlightenment values. Although, of course, in his later years, he was a proponent of that Tagorean Eastern spiritual civilization, and repudiated a lot of what the West had on offer. So
sounds like you're describing the Communist Party, China.
But this is the thing about someone like Liang and Aleph Ghani, in that in their short lives they incarnated political tendencies we've subsequently come to recognize, identify with China, with the Muslim world, and that's why I chose to write about them.
Mm-hmm.
Is because in all their sort of separate journeys that they managed to manifest these ideas that subsequent generations then adopted, put them to different uses, of course, altogether. But it shows just how ideologies emerge from particular contexts, particular historical, political contexts.
Are there discrete events that you can point to that seem to have been the inflection points in his thinking?
Well, the 1898 failure of the 100-day front, definitely one of them, but also the Boxer Rising, the Boer War in South Africa, which he wrote about in some detail, and the implications of that. 1905, of course, Russo-Japanese War, and then I think the First World War, the sheer slaughter, bloodshed there.
Yeah, that wholesale mechanistic death.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that really, gave him some new perspectives on what the Western emphasis on science and rationality, what that could amount to.
Right.
And then, of course, 1919, the great betrayal of many, many non-Western Asian countries at that conference.
Right. We tend here in China, of course, to focus on the betrayal of the Chinese in the Shandong question, handing over German-occupied territories on the peninsula to the Japanese, the so-called 21 demands and all that business. But what about this visit he made to the United States, which really culminated his visits to San Francisco's Chinatown? I mean, he drew some very pessimistic conclusions about the Chinese in this case. He calls them slavish, stupid, selfish, mendacious, timid, passive. I mean, it led him to the conclusion that, well, where have we heard this before? The Chinese are not ready for democracy.
No, but he had sort of quite a lot of interesting responses to America. Not only that, there was also his fear that America was turning into an imperialist nation and that democracy was ceasing to function effectively there because of the influence of corporate interests, increasing influence of corporate interests in politics, and the fact that politics in general in America was attracting a very mediocre kind of person, and the presidents were pretty second, third rate. Nothing much has changed.
Oh my God. Did you even really need to write this?
And the only thing that he approved of in terms of democracy in America was how it worked at the local level, at the level of the county and level of the township. But that he thought wasn't, of course, suitable for the Chinese, who tended to be too clannish, too tribalist, really, to think of themselves as citizens with equal rights of a democratic society. But it's interesting how he took away from that a kind of idea that what China really needs is a sort of enlightened autocracy, that you cannot really trust individual citizens with political awareness of any kind because they'll have a very underdeveloped one.
So he was the intellectual forebearer of Jackie Chan, in a sense.
You heard it here. Right. Yang Zhichao is Jackie Chan.
First time mentioned the same sentence.
He's not the only character in From the Ruins of Empire who has an American sojourn. You don't dwell on it as much as I've seen in other writings about Sayyid Qutb, but of course he very famously, of course, he was killed, executed in 1966. He was one of the founders of the Muslim Brotherhood, but he had that famous trip in the early 1950s, I believe it was.
That's right.
In the United States.
Yeah, late 1940s.
Late 1950s, okay.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how would you compare these two American journeys?
Well, they're fascinating. I mean, again, it's so instructive to put them together, to see two pretty intelligent, sensitive people from this part of the world traveling to the United States, encountering a different culture with its own set of priorities, and saying, well, this is not for us, and this is why. You know, obviously, they also said a lot of absurd things and quite a lot of incorrect things. They you know, misperceived certain things. But it's interesting because we are so accustomed to Western judgments on places like China or Egypt, and the sense that, you know, these people ought really be trying very hard to catch up with us, that we've basically set the standards for human existence in this part of human history for the last 150, 200 years or so. And everyone else, what they should be doing is basically imitating us. And what someone like Syed Qutb or Liang in different ways are saying, actually, you know, a lot of what you do doesn't work for us. It's not suited for our societies, particular societies. So that, however wrong-headed or absurd they might be, just opens up another perspective on the United States, on the West in general, and shows how the history of the West or history of Western modernity cannot be a template or cannot be a pattern for other societies to follow. There'll always be people resisting it, resisting this idea that all they have to look forward to is become like the United States of America.
But the foremost proponent in that time of that idea of rejecting the naked materialism, and I don't mean materialism in just the sense of acquisitiveness, but also in the philosophical sense of rejecting all the cluster of values that emerged with the Enlightenment, was, of course, Tagore. Let's talk a little bit about how he was received when he did come at the invitation of Liang Qichao and who was his other co-host? Zhang Junmai.
Yeah.
Zhang Junmai was his other he came to a China where the intellectual climate of the day was very enamored with logical positivism. It was into Dewey. It was into Bertrand Russell.
Absolutely.
And I mean, did he not know this? Did he know that? Did he know that he would be hooted at and really, I mean, quite roundly attacked with few defenders?
He had some experience of being unpopular in Japan previously, where he had sort of conveyed the same message he had been conveying in the United States and Britain, which was that modern nationalism is a deeply destructive force, and the civilization that the West has built through conquest and violence mostly was a highly destructive force. I think in Japan, which was then trying to imitate Western imperialism, this did not go down well at all. So he had quite a lot of strong responses to him. He was called someone from a defeated country.
Right.
I don't think he expected to be treated that way or to be rebuffed and to be booed or heckled when he went to China. Because he had been, he had been accustomed to pretty good treatment in places like America, for instance, or Europe, because after the First World War, both these societies were, sort of had been plunged into very deep self-doubt about science, about rationality, about progress in general, and about the values of the civilized West, because they'd all been sort of shattered by the First World War. Of course, places like China were on a different timeline altogether. What they had drawn from the lesson from the First World War and the Russian Revolution was that we need to modernize pretty fast, and the Russian communists had shown the way, and we also need to embrace, of course, a certain this kind of positivism, Mr. Science and Mr. Democracy. And so this was a complete shock to Tagore, actually.
But always, I mean, we'll get back to Tagore, but just, I mean, since you do mention the May 4th generation's embrace of Mr. Science and Mr. Democracy, I think we realize now the extent to which those were entirely instrumental embraces. And these were, they were seen as means to decidedly national ends. I think that that's something that we see. It's a thread that we see very clearly in somebody like Liang Qichao. I don't think that he was ever a liberal qua liberal who saw liberalism as an end in itself.
No.
I think that that actually goes very far in explaining a lot of attitudes today, why we see, I think, today so many apparently quite cosmopolitan and liberal-minded Chinese people who still have a deeply nationalistic streak, so that when liberal means and national ends collide, as they will often do, the ends will, of course, prevail.
Indeed. I mean, I think they had a really fascinating perspective on liberalism back then, Western liberalism, because they could see, I mean, we tend to think of liberalism as being in something in contradiction or something necessarily opposed to imperialism.
Right.
What a lot of these people saw very clearly in India too was that liberalism was complicit with imperialism. Mm. Not only that, mm-hmm. the whole idea of individual rights, individual freedoms had liberated certain energies within the West and had helped the West to become as successful and powerful as it had become. So in that sense, liberalism was the means to national strength and indeed in generalizing across the world, sort of imperialist strength. So this was a really very special vision that certainly you can't think of any Western thinker at that point being self-critical enough or reflective enough to arrive at that formulation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they were thinking very much of liberalism as sort of checking the excesses of imperialism.
In one of the last chapters in your book, when you look at basically China from Mao to now, one of the things that I think you point out is that, yes, this business of liberalism is a means to national ends. And you see Liang as somebody who was very suspicious of pure Western liberalism as too individualistic. He championed a more sort of communitarian form of liberalism, if such a thing is. You also saw him as presaging in many senses the kind of market socialism or state capitalism, whatever you want to call it, the authoritarian state capitalism that we talked about with Jim McGregor last week, that characterizes China today. I mean, that I thought that was a very, very well put and very, very interesting.
Again, I mean, if you think about that time, Liang in 1903, I mean, what he was witnessing, if you looked around, what you saw was Germany, which had managed to strengthen itself using precisely the methods of state capitalism. If you looked around and saw the United States, you saw the same thing. I think why we are slightly surprised by that is because we have been told,
we have short memories.
Short memories, and we've kind of grown up with this new liberal narrative where countries become capitalist and successful and important by embracing a certain kind of free market capitalism, which is basically what has been defined by the Washington Consensus in the last 20, 25 years. We forget that the United States built up its industrial strength, it's sort of...
they invented mercantilism, goddammit.
Absolutely, that is, yeah.
I think that one of the questions at the heart of the book, though, I mean, and this isn't so much later, it's the first half of the book for me. I was consumed with this question is, well, as these people are throwing out the core of what defines them culturally, whether it's repudiation of Islam or of Confucianism, what is left to build a nation on, to build a national identity on? Can national identity ever be divorced from cultural identity? I mean, and this is, I think, especially problematic in a civilization like China, where Chinese identity and Confucian identity are essentially coterminous. Was that ultimately a futile idea? I mean, and is that the reason that maybe we do see the ghost of Confucianism still sort of lingering?
It's a very interesting subject, that, because I think people talk a lot about how Japan managed to retain its cultural identity while modernizing. I just don't believe that. I mean, the fact is that Japan became an imperialist power in very much following the Western model, and actually lost its identity. I mean, what people like Liang and Tagore were talking about, what cultural identity consists of in this context is sticking very close to a certain ethical view of life, not using nature in an instrumental way, you know, maintaining a spirit of cooperation, privileging the spirit of cooperation over competition. There's certain values that were essential, that were sort of had been at the core of these largely agrarian societies for a long, very long time before they were challenged by these new, modern, very aggressive capitalist societies of the West. So how can one retain this particular identity that's been basically been around for a very long time? Obviously, it had gone, you know, minor changes here and there, but hadn't been radically transformed in the way people were asked to transform themselves in the modern era. And Japan was the first to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not quite sure. I mean, I think they saw very clearly that this is a package. Once you acquire this, once you buy into it, then you will have to transform every aspect of your national existence, of your social existence,
right,
that there'll be very little to hold on to. And one reason why there's sometimes a touch of hysteria in their responses to the West, because they can see, you know, that
it required the wholesale,
absolutely,
slaughter of your right.
And it did happen. It did happen. It happened here. It happened in Turkey. It happened in a lot of places.
In Turkey, but not in other places of the ex-Ottoman Empire, and which is interesting because I arguably Turkey has been a whole lot more successful in its. I mean, it's been frustrated, of course, as you point out in your book. Its inability to gain membership to the white man's club of the European Union and so forth.
I wonder if there's ever a way in which the most radical form of iconoclasm almost always has something held over or retrieved from the kind of package of the cultural past. So you could say, you know, with Japan, as much as was jettisoned, you still did have the trappings of the emperor as one thing connecting to the past. In China, we talk about Mao's sort of ultimate iconoclastic moments, but even then, he was tapping into traditions of peasant revolt. He was tapping into talking about himself as the Monkey King. He was tapping into sometimes alternative traditions, but even when you're borrowing something very, this new package, there's something about the trappings of it.
It's always thus. You can't escape your...
You can't escape it. But is that also sometimes a very cynical use of tradition or a very cynical invention of tradition to affirm, to maintain the status quo, to find new forms of ideological legitimacy for the status quo when we talk of Confucianism today and we talk about...
Absolutely. I mean, everything about history in this country and Confucianism and any kind of Chinese tradition is marshaled by the state in order to tell its own story, I think. I mean, China, for sure, it's that way.
Jeremy, let's talk about that. Earlier this afternoon, Jeremy and I were chatting, and we were really wondering, you know, what are the fruits of your protagonist's work? I mean, has anyone really found a way to be convincingly Asian and modern?
What are the fruits of their work? And also perhaps a question, and I don't know how much it applies to the other characters, but in the case of Liang, if you read some of his writings today, some of them you don't even have to change anything, and it looks like a critique of contemporary society. It seems
not just Liang, but like anything from the May 4th period.
Pretty much any. I mean, you know, and this has been a strong current in Chinese thinking that you see in the media and the writings of some intellectuals in the last couple of years. Okay, are we in the late Qing dynasty? Are we in the early Republican period? We have the same problems. We haven't solved any of these problems.
Read, like, you know, he's not from the mainland, but Boyang's Ugly Chinaman. I mean, read or watch River Elegy He Shang from the late 1980s. This is the same stuff. These are the same problems that they're wrestling. I wonder, I mean, even as we sit here in a China that clearly has gained ground, has really sort of settled into its identity as a modern nation state, a lot of these problems clearly persist.
So what's the question we're asking? What are the fruits of their works?
Well, I think they've left behind for us a critical resource, an intellectual resource to bring into use at this point when we are faced with this sort of massive worldwide crisis. Wherever you look, whether it's the United States, the originating country of globalization, the capital of Western modernity, or indeed the countries that are supposedly rising very fast, whether it's India or China, sort of racked by social unrest and the kind of problems that seem more or less insurmountable. You know, it's all very well to talk about the sort of GDP growth rates, which is what a lot of us have been doing for the last decade or so of these countries, and talk about how they are going to be, you know, economically as powerful, say, in the next 20, 30 years. But we know that this whole fantasy of bringing the lifestyles of a few hundred million Europeans and Americans to 2.6 billion people is no more than a fantasy. Mm-hmm. That will never be realized. It won't happen.
Not without, I mean, imperiling the very existence of the planet.
Absolutely, right? Yeah.
So, I mean, you recently published a piece specifically on this in the New York Times blog called What Will Asia Send in Spring? And, you know, it really echoes the epilogue of your book in many ways. That piece looks at the ramifications of what you call the East's stalled makeover in the image of the West. So clearly you have big misgivings about where things go from here, but I have trouble exactly nailing you down on what your prescription is. And, you know, try, if you could, to tell us where should we go from here? What do we do in these, you know, to cure what ails China and India and the other ascendant or soon to be ascendant Asian states? What was the alternative then? What is the alternative now?
Well, it's become increasingly difficult to think about alternatives at this point. But I think, especially when we're not even embarking upon as sort of national societies on a critique, or not self-aware enough at this point about where we're going wrong. I mean, we have been, you know, in the sort of catch-up mode for a long time. By we, I mean most non-Western societies, trying to catch up with the West that established a lead 150 years ago, having had the Industrial Revolution early on, having gone out and conquered these different continents and, you know, basically enlisted their resources, all these territories, into their own national consolidations. So, having established that lead, they then set the task for the rest of us to catch up. And we've been trying various means. Socialism, communism didn't work, and now we've, you know, adopted different forms of capitalism to do that. But now we're coming up against environmental constraints. But, you know, how much of this do you think national leaders in countries like India or China or Indonesia are thinking about? Because their legitimacy, whether they are elected or not, it's beside the point, rests on delivering prosperity, delivering the promises of globalization to their populations. Hardly any one of them is saying, actually, what we need to do is make local economies viable instead of attaching them all to the globalized economy, instead of exposing these farmers, for instance, in India, to international
One is articulating these visions, these of an alternative modernity.
Not amongst the ruling elites. There are thinkers, obviously, in all of these countries. There are writers who are talking about this. But the ruling elites are very much, you know, locked into this fantasy of, well, some of them actually are not locked into. They're aware that this is not going to end well. But there they are. They have made that promise, and they have to keep looking as if they are going to meet it. So I think the alternatives are to think about non-urban, non-industrial modes of existence, because obviously, you know, you can't have, maybe it's possible in China, I don't know. But in India, it's definitely not possible for the vast majority of the population to start living in cities, to move to urban centers. We just simply don't have the resources. We don't have the infrastructure at this point. And then even if we do come up with the infrastructure, we don't have the resources to sustain 1.2 billion people living in the city. So what do we do to make life viable for them back where they live right now, in the villages? What is it that we need to do? That's the kind of thinking that should start happening. I have to say, I was just in Indonesia, where I did come across actually a very interesting instance of localization. A mayor of Solo, who instead of just simply obstructing property developers and shopping mall owners or foreign retailers from coming into his town, what he tried to do was quite successfully support local businessmen, small traders, you know, stall people who sell street foods, and has been immensely successful to the point he was sort of winning 90% of the votes, you know, Saddam Hussein-like voting percentages in these elections. And he's just now been elected mayor of Jakarta. But he really is an example of how encouraging local crafts like batik, which is so much a part of the identity of the Javanese people in that part of Java, how you can both foster a sense of identity, you know, maintain a sense of continuity with the past, and also encourage, you know, local businessmen.
Is a neo-traditionalism, is an embrace of spiritual civilization necessarily a part of that?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, we've shrunk for far too long from the spiritual, as it were, and seeing it in something airy-fairy. But I think the way in which it was deployed by people like Tagore or Liang, we have much to learn from these figures.
I mean, I would push back a little on that. I mean, you write in your book, Tagore and Liang Tichao represented a strong early trend, still visible today, of Asian intellectuals defining Western modes of politics, economics, science, and culture as inhumanly utilitarian. Well, I mean, I look around me in modern China, at least, and I mean, I see almost no evidence of this. I don't know, Jeremy or Jeff, if you agree with me, but I mean, instead, I see embrace in some to some extent of the Western mode of politics. It's no longer a question of whether a more sort of pluralistic and participatory system comes into being, but at what rate such a system comes into being. It's a country where, you know, the practitioners of capitalism are kind of gloating because they're practicing it in an even more pure form, or so they would believe. I mean, you hear bromides about harmonious society and things like this, but it's just cloaked in Confucian garb. I mean, really, Jeremy, you were saying the raison d'être of the party today.
Right, it's purely utilitarian.
It's
I mean, don't see it in China, at least. I mean, you don't see any attempt by the elites or the state to inculcate any other value, it seems to me, aside from a really brutish kind of materialism. You know, it's
even the manifestations of religion that I do see are shockingly material in their manifestation. I mean, they're horrid. They remind me of that Nam-myoho Renge-kyo cult in California in the 80s, where you would pray for a VCR or a chant for a BMW. I mean, it's...
If we're going to try to be helpful, do you see anything to be helpful in the shift in at least some of the protests, the NIMBY protests and things like that, toward kind of quality of life issues, which are not crudely materialist? I mean, or maybe it's redefining utilitarian.
It's materialist
about breathable
almost
air, you know.
Right, but
water.
But it's my breathable air.
Right, it's not, still it's not, ultimately.
Who cares about the peasant over there, right? Isn't it?
That's the limit.
Isn't that the non-spiritual?
That's
part of
the limit of it. That's the limit of it.
Maybe it probably was India that I had too much in mind when I wrote that sentence, because I do remember coming here with Arundhati Roy a few years back, and she brought to my attention that there is actually, you know, she couldn't find much evidence of political movements or thinkers, for that matter, who were pushing back, who were sort of formulating, you know, responses to this.
It's really not much different. I mean, you're Tagore again, coming to a China that's still brutally and unapologetically materialistic. Anyway,
well, hopefully nobody's going to throw eggs, though.
Right, nobody's going to. I
you put me on a very high pedestal there.
I absolutely loved your book, though.
Thanks very much.
And I highly recommend it. And speaking of recommendations, I want to move on to the segment of our show where we do make recommendations of things that we've read or things that we've seen that may be of interest to the Seneca readership or listenership. I know I've got one cocked and ready. Why don't we start with you, Jeremy?
Yeah, I'd just like to mention a small piece by our guest, Pankaj, which was a takedown of Niall Ferguson, which I kind of
everyone's read
about
that
halfway already through this podcast, and I don't remember where it was published.
It was
but
the
I think it's the most
entertaining,
intelligent piece of writing I've read in a long, long time. So I'd recommend that.
That okay. I mean, I read that, and I grinned the whole way through it, but I felt you actually made me feel bad for the man. You actually made me feel.
Oh, I'm really sorry about that.
I actually was. The empathy in me went out to him, and I felt like I would just kill myself if somebody were to.
I don't think he would, and that's why it was such a wonderful.
It was funny because I had just reread Gatsby right before.
Oh yes,
and how you open with that with Tom's diatribe about the imperiled white man. It was very well. Good recommendation, Jeremy. Very good recommendation. What was the title of that?
Watch oh, yeah, this right. man.
No, I think that's right. Right. Watch this racist boob.
Well, obviously, the book I think you should all go out to read is Niall Ferguson's Civilization. Wonderful book. No. I was just planning to use a lousy pun and say, since it's a podcast about China, the book is China Meville, who's a science fiction writer who I found impossible to get away from because I would run Google searches or Baidu searches when I'm in China.
Of course.
And of course, when I would look for something about China and something else, I'd be taken to the review of the latest book by this author whose first name happens to be China. But I finally read this book by him, The City and the City, which I thought of as getting away from thinking about China and reading some science fiction that also has the qualities of a hard-boiled detective story. So these are the two escapist kinds of reading I do. But it turned out to be very useful to think about one part of Chinese history that I keep coming back to, which is Shanghai at the period when it was a divided city. And people were living in one city, but actually living in some ways in very different realms. And this is fiction, which is often seen as more about the Balkans and divides there. But it actually is very useful to think about these cities that are topographically overlapping, but in some ways are made to seem different worlds and the blurring of boundaries between them. Right. So I'm on my way to Shanghai, so it's on my mind.
Very good, very good. Actually, the only book by that author that I've read was recommended to me by the guy whose essay I'm about to recommend. I didn't particularly care for it personally, but Pankaj, what do you have for us?
I'm going to recommend, completely impartially, of course, a book I wrote a foreword to. A book that I realized after writing a foreword to actually has some amazing stuff in it. It's a book called Chinese Characters, edited by our...
Some guy
called Jeffrey Wostrom and Anjali Shah. And it has, I think, some of the best journalists, some of the best writers at work in China and on China. Today, I think we are actually going through a golden age of journalism on China.
Jeffrey, roll down a list of some of the great people who are in there.
And a lot of them have been on Seneca. Evan Osnos, Peter Hessler, Leslie Chong, Christina Larson, Shujin Eberlein, wow. Jim Millward, who has a cameo appearance by Kaiser in his chapter on guitar players. Shredding for the Motherland is the title of the chapter. I think it's the best title of a chapter. I won't pick a favorite chapter, but
he actually that chapter is about my other guitar player Ko Jung Yu, who is a delightful character. It's about him playing in a Shakespeare. What's the name of the? Oh my God! What's the name of the Shakespeare play?
Corleanus. And Anant Krishnan is in it too, which I think is important because it's, yeah.
Anant is great. He's been on Seneca, yeah.
Oh, okay, great. And it's also a different kind of India-China crossover there in his perspective.
Yeah, great. I've got it on my Kindle and I'll be reading it soon. And last to me, of course, Mo Yan has been awarded with Nobel Prize for Literature. There's been quite a bit of controversy around him. A lot of the more strident rightists on Weibo leapt out to attack him, Ai Weiwei among them. There's a very, very good defense written by Brendan O'Kane, who's a prolific and very talented translator. He wrote on the group blog rectified.name. The title is Mo Yan a stooge for the Communist Party? And, you know, the perfunctory answer is no. He I think, does a terrific treatment of Mo Yan's works. And I think Mo Yan, I mean, I'll say my two cents, I think it was an incredibly classy way to go about it, to work within the system, to achieve that sort of rarefied pedestal, and then from it, once there, to pronounce his
well,
design.
We'll see about that, Kaiser.
We'll see about that. But, I mean, it was classy.
One offhand remark about Liu Xiaobo does not make somebody into somebody who's
I'm not
fighting for writers and a decent approach to not locking up your citizens.
Still, I mean, in the context of things these days, it was a pretty brave thing for him to do. Anyway, I want to thank you very much, Pankaj, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It was a delight talking to you. And Jeffrey, as always, next time you're in town, swing on by. We'll have you on again.
You bet. I'll take you up on that.
Jeremy, as always.
Thank you, Kaiser.
And we will talk to you folks next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care.